Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. My name is Federica Gosta. I'm an associate professor of neurology at Vita Salute Sarafele University and Ospedale Sarafele in Milano, Italy. Today, I'm very pleased to present the updated guideline for the management of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. As you may know, ALS is a progressive neurodegenerative condition affecting motor neurons. ALS is not only progressive, but it is unfortunately a fatal neurodegenerative condition characterized by degeneration of motor neurons in the brain and in the spinal cord, associated with many other extra motor clinical manifestations. So ALS results in muscular weakness, paralysis, cognitive dysfunction, and ultimately in respiratory failure. Despite extensive research, nowadays ALS remains a challenging for every neurology. And it's very complicated to manage the disease effectively in every patient. I'm very happy today to introduce my guest, Professor Philip Van Damme. Philip is a professor of neurology at the University of Leuven in Belgium. Philip is leading the ALS Centrum in Leuven. He's not only a great clinician, but he's also a great scientist involved since many years in both clinical and research associated with ALS. Philip has also a very long-standing experience in clinical trials in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. So welcome, Philip. I'm very happy to be here together with you today. First of all, I would like to ask you, which was the process behind these guidelines?
So thank you, Federica. So this guideline was commissioned by EAN, and that was timely because the previous guideline dated already back to 2012. So it was really time for an update. And the guideline was made in close collaboration with also the ERN Euro NMD and the organization ENCALS and the European Patient Organization EUPALS. And for the guideline, we followed great methodology and we were supported by Cochrane Response. So it was an intense collaboration with Cochrane Response, which I was very happy with this collaboration. So the first step was to make the composition of the guideline panel, which consisted of key opinion leaders from 13 different European countries, and then also two reviewers from Cochrane and patient representation as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. Thank you for this effort. Thank you for and the other colleagues for this important work. So going deeply within the guidelines, I'd like to start by asking about the general focus behind the guidelines. And so what are the major recommendations for medication use in patients with ALS?
So the general scope of the guideline was quite broad because we try to cover the most important aspects of the management of ALS. So ranging from disease modifying therapies, but also multidisciplinary care, how to deal with communication problems, malnutrition, respiratory symptoms, end-of-life care. And also there's a quite an extensive list of disabling symptoms of which can happen in ALS, for which both non-pharmacological and pharmacological therapies are discussed. So it's a quite broad list of topics that are being covered in this guideline.
And regarding the drugs that the few drugs that can be used in these patients, I mean, regarding riluzole and tofersen, what was the recommendation for prescribing? What was the evidence supporting the choice for one treatment or the other one in these patients?
So in terms of the disease-modifying treatments, this is indeed the two drugs we currently have available for ALS patients. Maybe first a few words about riluzole. Riluzole is already around for a very long period of time. There were two RCTs in the 90s that showed the effectiveness of riluzole. Unfortunately, the effect size is not very large, but the evidence that it does something is conclusive. With regards to the optimal timing of riluzole, when to start, is it necessary to keep taking it during the whole disease course? There's not so good evidence, but on the other hand, there are studies that show that it's better to start it early, and there's also studies that show that it's still effective late in disease. So therefore, we came up with the recommendation to offer it lifelong to all people with ALS at diagnosis, so as soon as possible and lifelong. It is known that riluzole can have some side effects, mostly nausea and some fatigue. And if patients experience this, it's worth trying to reduce the dose, because also the half of the normal dose, which is 2 times 50 milligrams a day, is still effective. Some patients really do not tolerate it, and then, of course, you should consider stopping riluzole. Tofersen, the second disease-modifying therapy we have now available, that's, of course, a game-changer to the field, because the effect size there is much bigger. It is a antisense oligonucleotide therapy, gene silencing therapy, directed against the SOT1 gene, and it's only for patients that have a pathogenic SOT1 mutation. But it has been shown that it can clearly reduce neurofilament levels, which is a biomarker of neuronal injury, and later on also stabilize the disease course in patients with SOT1 mutations. And there we recommend to give it as a first-line therapy to patients with a pathogenic SOT1 mutation. And of course, this is really exciting for the field, because it's the first time that we can offer a treatment with such an effect. We have never seen anything like that before in the field of ALS.
Yes, actually, it's also the first time that a drug is approved based on a biomarker effect more than on a clinical effect. I think it's really important, not only for ALS, but also for other neurodegenerative conditions.
Yeah, and there the timing was very important. So the biomarker effect is there really quickly after weeks of treatment. The clinical response takes longer to appear. That's a lesson the field has learned. And so that's why, yeah, it takes longer to see the clinical effects.
Yeah. And what about the side effects for tofersen?
So in general, it's well tolerated. Of course, the administration is quite invasive. It's bimonthly lumbar puncture, so intrathecal injections. There can be side effects related to the administration with post-punction headaches and so on. But there are also some serious side effects possible due to the treatment. And then we think mostly of a myelitis that can occur, and also some intracranial pressure that is increased with headaches and papilledema. But these side effects are occurring in about 5% of patients, and of course should be discussed upfront. In particular, for instance, in patients with mutations that are typically associated with a very slow disease progression, it's important to tailor the effects and the potential side effects.
Thank you. And another important point of the guidelines is the fact that they cover not only pharmacological intervention, but also non-pharmacological intervention for patients with motor neuron disease, including specifically nutrition and respiratory deficits in patients with ALS. Starting from nutrition, which are the main recommendations that you have describe in this guideline?
It's true that malnutrition is one of the most important negative prognostic factors of survival. So trying to avoid weight loss is important in patients that have swallowing problems and weight loss. It's important first to try to optimize the intake, and ask advice from dietitians and speech therapies and even occupational therapists to see how the feeding process can be improved. But at some point, it may not be enough to prevent further malnutrition. And then the decision has to be taken whether patients and their carers want to go for a gastrostomy or not. In the guideline, we stress that it's important not to delay this decision, to be aware of the benefits of an early placement of gastrostomy and also about the potential risk of late gastrostomy placement. In patients that also develop respiratory weakness, it's important to first treat that and put them on non-invasive ventilation because that can clearly reduce the risk of the gastrostomy placement and even to perform the ventilation, the non-invasive ventilation during the procedure where the gastrostomy is placed, because this can clearly reduce the early mortality in the days and weeks after the gastrostomy placement.
And so you were discussing also about the respiratory management. So which were the precise recommendations for respiratory failure in ALS patients?
So respiratory failure is the most important cause of death of patients with ALS. And we know already since 2006, then the first randomized controlled trial was performed, that NIV can prolong survival of patients with ALS. Ever since, there are numerous other studies and observational studies that clearly show the benefit of NIV. But there's less evidence about what is the optimal timing to start it and also how should you pick up the respiratory failure. So some sites, for instance, mostly rely on respiratory function tests, slow vital capacity, forced vital capacity. Others also use nocturnal CO2 measurements or nocturnal oximetry. And so for the guideline, we wanted to be inclusive and also build in some flexibility. And the final recommendation is that NIV should be offered to all patients with ALS with either symptoms, signs, or laboratory investigation supportive of respiratory failure. So which means that if you are used to a certain method to measure pulmonary function and respiratory failure, you can use that method. And that has the advantage, because the disadvantage of picking clear cutoffs on one respiratory test is that it's never only one value that determines whether you start or wait with the intervention. It's always a much more complex picture where there's many other factors that play. Also, the speed with which the pulmonary function declines is important. Social factors, how well is are there caregivers that can support, and so on. So it's not just one value on a test that can really say yes or no. It's much more complicated than that.
And do you think that we are ready to use biomarkers in order to orient our choice, not only for pharmacological intervention, but also for non-pharmacological intervention? I mean, how far we are from precision medicine in patients with ALS? I know it's a very difficult question, sorry.
No, I think it's very interesting. We are at the tipping point with the first precision medicine approach for ALS, tofersen for patients with a SOT1 mutation. And there, we don't really use biomarkers to define the moment to initiate the therapy, but we clearly use them to monitor the therapy. And I think that's a first very important step forward. For other problems like non-invasive ventilation, I think we need more research, because now there is a trend towards earlier initiation of the therapy, which can be an advantage. That's not very convincingly shown. But on the other hand, we also know that if you start non-invasive ventilation in patients that do not have dyspnea or orthopnea, they are less likely to be compliant to the therapy. So it's a trade-off. It's also not good to start too early with these interventions. Patients also experience them sometimes as a failure, because it means the disease has progressed. So I think there's a lot of room for further studies to do.
And another point which is only marginally touched by the guideline is the management of cognitive behavioral deficits. What is your opinion as an expert?
That's a really important topic. Up to 50% of patients are not completely normal in terms of cognition and behavior. In about 10 to 15%, these changes are severe enough to make a diagnosis of behavioral variant FTD. And clearly that has a big impact on the management of ALS. It can influence the decision taking, also the compliance of patients to therapy. But for the guideline, at the beginning, we had lengthy discussions what to do with it. There is virtually no evidence on what to do in case of FTD or severe cognitive or behavioral impairment. And so therefore, we made a kind of disclaimer saying that it's very important to look for it, to evaluate if patients are still able to express their preferences and so on, and take into account the findings if you assess cognition and behavior. But we didn't adapt every recommendation for patients with or without cognitive impairment, because it's sometimes quite surprising if you have a patient with ALS and some FTD or frontotemporal changes, they're less likely to be compliant to non-invasive ventilation, but some of them do quite well. So there is no, you cannot always predict.
It's clear. Okay. And a very last question. So tofersen is the first drug that can be used also in patients with the genetic ALS. And do you think that how far we are from using treatment in subjects carrying mutation, but without any clinical manifestation? So treatment of asymptomatic genetic subjects.
That's also a very interesting area of research, because it's known in general in neurodegenerative diseases, if you treat too late and too much damage is done, it's much less likely that you will see positive effects. So the earlier you start treatment, the more likely you are to prevent neuronal damage. And of course, in patients, or I should say in subjects that carry a mutation, you probably also don't want to start a treatment 20 years before they will get the disease. But now I think also there for tofersen, there's a nice example of the ATLAS study, where patients that start to develop the first rise in neurofilament will be randomized to treatment versus placebo. And then you can really see whether the treatment can also prevent the real outbreak of the disease, or at least delay it. And so I think that is, of course, the real future, because then you can keep individuals that carry the mutation at a normal level of functioning, hopefully for a long time.
Yeah. Okay, yes, I think that it's really exciting, as we've discussed with Professor Van Damme. We are really entering a new era for the management of patients with ALS and other neurodegenerative conditions. I think that ALS is a really good example of a field in which the advancement is clear, is really evident. And so we are really happy. And thank you again, Philippa. Thank you all. I hope you have enjoyed the discussion. And see you soon, also on behalf of the ALS and frontotemporal dementia panel of the EAN. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.